You're all very welcome today. This is the third event in the series of the University of Ulster University's Institute of Research and Social Sciences events on Who Cares About Politics. So what we wanted to focus on today was really a very topical issue around the Stormont House Agreement and one specific area, which is around how do historians deal with the past and the aftermath of the Stormont House Agreement. Just to remind you of what the agreement actually says, because I know not all of you are reading it as your bedtime reading every night. It says the executive will, by 2016, establish an oral history archive to provide a central place for people of all backgrounds and from throughout the UK and Ireland to share experiences and narratives related to the Troubles. As well as collecting new material, the archive will attempt to draw together and work with existing oral history projects. And the research project will be established as part of the archive, led by academics, to produce a factual historical timeline and statistical analysis of the Troubles. So that is the kind of political context. I'm a lecturer in Peace and Conflict Studies based on the McGee campus at INCOR. And our panellists, some of whom are in the university and some who are from elsewhere, have been asked to come along to speak to the issue of the role of history and historians. Dr. Adrian Grant, a research associate with Transitional Justice Institute, Susan McKay, a writer and journalist, who has looked at issues around dealing with the past for many years, and Killian McGrattan, a lecturer in politics. But before we kick off, I just wanted to, I suppose, reflect on, you know, what does it mean to be a historian, to think about issues around dealing with the past and the historical context? And as I was thinking about the preparation for this event today, I was recalling a very pertinent input to a conference which was organised by Healing Through Remembering, actually now 10 years ago in 2005, where the Irish historian Kevin Whelan was reflecting on the role of historians in dealing with the past. And I'm just going to read out a very short extract of what he said, and hopefully that will stimulate some of the discussions today. He said, "In the 1980s, a television history of Ireland was produced by Robert Key. In the very first shot of that series, the camera hovers over the cobbles of a narrow Belfast street, while an old woman with a distinctively Cork accent begins to intone a very heavily unreconstructed nationalist view of Irish history. Here, the narrow street suggests the narrow mind. The old droning feminised voice shows the Irish to have a confused, non-linear, an ultimately lethal version of their own history. The closing shot of that sequence was of a sudden massive bomb erupting out of the Belfast streets, drowning out the droning voice. The next shot was taken from a helicopter, panning over the landscape of Ulster, accompanied by Key's standard estuarine English voice. Here the medium is the message. The high-level survey is way more important than ground truth. The professional historian, high up in his helicopter, has a much better synoptic view than the little people trapped in the narrow streets of Belfast. Again, the not-so-subtle message is that the danger of our history lurks not up in the helicopter, but in the streets. It is the streets' lethal, toxic, or contaminated versions of history that have fed the bomb and the bullet. Therefore, we need to establish a rational history as opposed to an emotional memory, a more objective history as opposed to a subjective memory." He goes on to say, "Professional historians have set themselves up as opposed to memory, as something that is subjective, emotional, irrational, and ultimately dangerous. Therefore, a common response by historians is to hector us to move beyond or decommission memory." There's a lot in that, and hopefully over the course of the next hour, we'll explore some of these topics, first from our speakers, and then we'll open it up to the floor and to discussion. Please feel free to go up, stand up and grab a cup of tea or refresh your tea. You know, this is an informal event and you know, we want to encourage discussion. So I'm going to try and be the timekeeper for the three speakers, and then we'll field discussion afterwards. Thank you. We'll start with Adrian.
Okay, thanks, Grania. The quote from Kevin Whelan ties in a lot with what I'm going to say, mainly about the role of professional historians and their potential role in dealing with the past. And the main question I want to ask is, are historians the right people to address the legacy of the past in post-conflict societies? Historians would seem to be the perfect fit in order to do this. They're much cheaper than lawyers anyway, which is one of the motivating factors, I think. And if we look at the Stormont House Agreement, it's mainly about financial issues. If you look at the detail of it, there's a huge section at the start of it which deals with welfare reform, etc. And the legacy issues and issues to do with flags, emblems and identity are sort of tacked on to the end of it. If the Stormont House Agreement is to come out of these difficulties, or if it's not to come out of the difficulties it's currently facing, it's likely that it'll be due to fiscal issues rather than legacy or identity issues. And this is new for Northern Ireland, and it's perhaps a sign of change in priorities. But I'm here today to give my perspective as a historian as to whether or not we as a profession, first of all, should involve ourselves in addressing legacy issues, and secondly, to ask whether we are a suitable profession to do so. This debate has been going on within the sort of professional historical community for quite some time as to what is the purpose of history, or what is history in some senses. So is it a scientific process of collating facts and presenting the evidence in a very cold and clinical way? That perspective would tend towards the view that objective truth is possible through the historical research process. There's another interpretation that writing history is in fact more of an art form, that historians gather the evidence that is presented to them, the available evidence, and then present a narrative which is their interpretation of the past. So two kind of different views of what history is. But I think the best way of going into a little bit of detail about those two interpretations is to look at the thoughts of two historians who were writing in the 1960s on this very issue in very broad terms. The first of these is Geoffrey Elton, who, in a book called The Practice of History, forwarded the argument that the construction of historical narrative is conducted by professional historians in an objective sense through the rigorous analysis of documentary sources. The historian, therefore, has received professional training in order to overcome bias and the danger of projecting the present onto the past. Historians don't, therefore, approach the past in order to prove a question that they've already answered. Moral judgments are also left aside. So this approach can be best summed up by stating that historians allow the sources to guide them, rather than historians selecting the sources in which to prove their points. The second interpretation, the less scientific interpretation, is associated with another historian called E.H. Carr, who, in a book called What is History, argued that the past is made up of a multitude of facts, and that historians choose which of these facts will become, in quotes, historical facts. In other words, historians inevitably have to choose from the multitude of facts, and their own biases will impact on which facts they deem to be most important. A quote from Carr's book will sum this up succinctly better than I can here, so I'll just quote that. It's not too long. And he says, "The facts are really not like fish on the fishmonger's slab. They are like fish swimming around in a vast and sometimes inaccessible ocean. And what the historian catches will depend partly on chance, but mainly on what part of the ocean he chooses to fish in and what tackle he chooses to use. These two factors being, of course, determined by what kind of fish he wishes to catch. By and large, the historian will get the kind of facts he wants. History means interpretation." So two very different approaches to what history is and how we write history. I suppose you can choose to agree with either of them, and this might be contradictory, but I think I agree with elements of both interpretations. I think Carr is right, E.H. Carr is right, in saying that historians have their biases like everybody else, and that certain sources will appear more appealing to their worldview as presented in the past. However, I also believe that most historians try to be objective in approaching the past and to allow their sources to guide them to a large extent. For instance, if a historian finds something that completely contradicts the narrative of their work in progress, it would be completely unethical to ignore that evidence and continue writing. And no self-respecting professional historian would do this. However, the biases of the historian will sometimes mean that they will never find such contradictory sources, since they are not looking for them. Even if they stumble across them, or if colleagues point them in the direction of such contradictory sources, their subconscious biases can often mean that they will interpret, or, to use a more modern phrase, spin the sources to suit their narrative. This isn't to say that this is a conscious process, but one that is influenced by diverse issues, ranging from prevailing political circumstances, social norms, and even something like personal career advancement could come into play. So the question is, can we trust the historian to write an honest, accurate, value-free, and as near to objective possible history as possible? Before I finish up speaking, I just want to go into detail about an example of how this might have been approached in the past. And I'll use the example of the Irish Revolutionary period, which is generally 1912 to 1923. The way in which the history of that period has been written would suggest that producing an objective, value-free history is very difficult to achieve. I would urge anyone with an interest in how the history of Southern Irish state formation has been written to consult a book that was published last year called Myth and the Irish State. The author, John Regan, is a historian of the period. He's a history lecturer in Dundee, University of Dundee. He has studied the period and the historiography of that period and come to the conclusion that a large number of historians have ignored vital evidence which questions the democratic legitimacy of the Southern Irish state. He questions the propensity for historians of the period to subscribe to the Democrats and dictators thesis of the pro and anti-treaty sides in the Civil War. And he also asks whether evidence that suggests Michael Collins' dictatorial powers have been ignored. He also criticises the application of present-day terminology and morality and values to the revolutionary period. So the book goes into a huge amount of detail on how the modern conflict in Northern Ireland had an enormous effect on how the history of Irish state formation has been written. Essentially, the democratic origins of the state were emphasised. The Easter Rising was relegated as the genesis moment of the Irish state in favour of the 1922 general election to give it a more democratic legitimacy rather than a revolutionary, violent upsurge. Those historians critically writing about the Southern Irish state and its formation were in some cases termed provos or Republican sympathisers or worse. So it was a very difficult time for historians to go against the consensus. Regan's charges haven't actually resulted in the kind of reaction you might expect from the historical community. He and those who make similar claims are often dismissed as peddling conspiracy theories, to which he has replied it's more of a consensus theory, because everyone seems to be writing the same type of history and there's very little challenge to that. And we're talking here within the Irish universities and UK universities with people writing about Irish history, rather than what are termed popular or non-professional historians. So, just a couple of questions. Does addressing the legacy of the conflict mean that historians will automatically approach their sources with a prior agenda? that agenda being to help the healing process, help reconciliation in society. If that is so, if that is the point of approaching the past, I don't think it would be good for the profession, and I think the history that would be produced would be inferior. I think, though, that historians can help address the legacy of conflict by simply doing their jobs. There will always be people ready to write the history. All they need are the sources and the right atmosphere into which they can release their findings. So I don't think we should set out to purposefully dispel myths or correct narratives we deem to be incorrect or inflammatory. The myths and narratives that we will inevitably choose to contradict will automatically betray a lack of objectivity. So, for example, if someone wants to contradict the Republican narrative specifically, then that betrays a sort of lack of objectivity. That is, if they don't, you know, tackle every narrative equally. And that's the last thing I just want to get to in talking about narratives. What is the narrative of the past? And if we are properly to address the legacy of the past here, it must be everyone's past that we address, and not just the narratives of national or religious identities. Silencing the suppressed narratives, for instance, the stories of ethnic minorities, the labour movement, the LGBT community, those who suffered abuse by state and non-state groups, and various other sectors of society that we don't often think about when we look at the past in Northern Ireland. Those suppressed narratives need to be appreciated now if they are to be properly incorporated into our history.
Thank you, Adrian. We'll pass over to Killian McGrathen next.
Okay, I'm taking as the point of departure the same point that Adrian made. I'm going to read a bit, and I'm going to extrapolate a bit of my notes. The question really that frames this presentation is the question that I took from the kind of the wee abstract, namely, can an oral history archive bring us any closer to the quote unquote truth of what happened? My answer is in two parts. The first part is that I don't know of any oral history that's actually taking place in Northern Ireland at the minute. I know of plenty of storytelling initiatives, but I don't know of any oral history, so in a way it's impossible to answer that question. The second part of my question is that... the second part of my answer is that the tenor, the type, the political implications of those storytelling narratives, if they go into legislation as the Stormont House Agreement envisages, well, they won't bring us any closer to the truth, and they will lead to very politically problematic possibilities. Okay, so in order to expound that two-part answer then, last year, Cathal McLaughlin, professor of film studies at QUB, promoted his storytelling video project, which, if you don't know, ex-prisoners and jailers reminisce about the past by suggesting that it represents an alternative to what he called politicians' record of failure. Now, I'm not here to defend politicians. I would just point out in parentheses that dealing with the past section of HAAS was agreed, and I've heard lots of cultural studies type academics at events in the Lyric talking about how bad politicians are, so on and so forth. Well, actually, the politicians agreed that section in Haas O'Sullivan, and it's not, as I understand it, the sections on the past that are causing the problems at the minute, as Adrian pointed out. It's the sections on the economy. So politicians have succeeded in kind of working through and reaching agreement on ways forward. I want to suggest the danger is twofold in the attack on politicians. Namely, raising expectations to a level that is so high that politicians cannot hope to meet it, though of course storytelling projects have a ready-made answer. And secondly, that answer provided by storytelling, as I already mentioned, may be taken so seriously by politicians that it becomes part of a legislative framework. What's my problem with storytelling? I agree with nearly everything about what Adrian says. My the one thing I would add is my central problem with storytelling is that it is not held to the peer review process that professional historians are. There's no necessarily the object of storytelling is to service local needs. As Adrian pointed out, the object of professional historians is different. So, just to explain, just as individual identity is based on memory, so too are national and community or communal identities based on some form of collective remembrance. However, memory in and of itself, as the historian Tony Jupp pointed out, is a poor guide to the past. Surveying the history of neglect, evasion and selective framing, which characterised many European countries' remembrance of the Second World War and the Holocaust, Jutt argued that the surfeit of commemoration, the surfeit of memory, didn't actually begin to address or confront the collective trauma of 1933 to 1945. It was only when the Germans began to appreciate, for example, and digest the enormity of their past that they were able to put it behind them. For Jutt, then, it was history, both in the sense of the professionalised study of the past and the passage of time, rather than memory or commemoration that facilitated that process. A professionalised study of the past, and Adrian's pointed out some of what that involves, I would argue stands in contrast to the methodology of storytelling. Just to be clear, I'm not questioning oral history, I'm not questioning history, I'm questioning the assumption that storytelling, conflation of storytelling with history or oral history. And I'm arguing that the methodologies of history and oral history stand in contrast to storytelling. The point is that it's one thing to claim that all stories should be heard, it's another thing to claim that all stories should be equally valorised. Again, I point here to McLaughlin's defence that, quote, participants seem to feel validated when their experiences are publicly acknowledged. That may well be the case, but what is the political, what are the ethical implications of that? If memory and commemoration and politically loaded memory work is taken as a surrogate for the historical record, then we risk, paradoxically, a surplus of memory being used to construct a political and historical reality that has more to do with the cult of violence than the actuality of hurt. In other words, it displaces the trauma of political violence and the experience of victimhood with the stories, with the old yarns of the perpetrators. Jutt alludes to this idea and he frames it as a basic political and moral principle. Quote, human suffering should not be calibrated according to the goals of the perpetrators. How long do I have left, Ronja?
4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. If I just extrapolate then to the Stormont House Agreement, because the Stormont House Agreement, paragraph 22, suggests or posits the possibility of setting up an oral history archive that will, quote, attempt to draw together and work with existing oral history projects, end quote. Now, I suggest that if that is taken as a letter, as an exact letter of law, it might actually be very difficult to find any oral history projects, as they're commonly understood elsewhere. So, what is the problem then with this? First of all, the terms of submission are voluntary. I suggest that voluntary should not be confused with inclusive or exhaustive, or the principle set out in the Stormont House Agreement, namely proportionate, balanced, transparent, fair and equitable. I would suggest that won't happen for three reasons. A definition of inclusiveness or inclusivity that fits the reality of the Troubles would be proportionate to the killings. So there would be a much more higher proportion of IRA victims than deaths linked to the actions of state forces or loyalist terrorists. Basically, the breakdown is contained in Lost Lives, for example, is 60-30-10. Republicans responsible for 60% of the deaths, loyalists 10, state forces, loyalists 30, state forces 10, approximately. I suggest that won't happen because there's been a much higher profile sought and given to the Republican narrative of the Troubles. And in part, you know, this is fair enough, this is to do with Sinn Féin's commemoration industry. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, it's a political mobilisation. But it can be hard to match up with inclusivity and proportionality. Of course, there's always a silencing that occurs when people are not allowed to speak. We've had spotlight, and Adrian's alluded to abuse cases where silence has been perpetrated within nationalism and republicanism. Of course, there's also privatised mourning. Existing archives, some of the ones that I've looked at in terms of storytelling, don't seem to have very much about repression within republicanism or within loyalism. I might be wrong about that. But I would welcome being proved wrong about that. Again, storytelling projects aren't held up to the same standards that historians are, simply through the process of peer review. To come back to McLaughlin's point about acknowledgement, this seems to be underpinning a lot, and it's contained in the Haas of Sullivan paper as well. If the point is acknowledgement, well, I'm not too sure how that is actually going to be reached in terms of policy. I refer here to Christopher Hitchens' point that which can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. If people want an acknowledgement, storytelling doesn't seem to necessarily meet Hitchens' standard. One final point to close on then. The Stormont House Agreement doesn't specify full disclosure, such as in the South African case. It sets up two mechanisms, an historical investigations unit and information retrieval unit. The information retrieval unit is essentially combining the HET and the policing investigative processes. The HIU, as I understand it, is based around truth recovery, stroke storytelling. The scenario of cross-testimony isn't addressed, as I can see it, in the Stormont House Agreement. What I mean by this is, what happens if one political group decide to embark on the storytelling side of things, the HIU, and another group embarks on the juridical side of things, the forensic police investigation. What happens if some victims groups decide to go down the road of forensic recovery and others that of storytelling? Will evidence submitted to the storytelling body be deemed inadmissible to the forensic judicial point of view? To come back to my first point about the problems, well, the problems of storytelling is put into legislation is an overturning of what's considered traditional due process and criminal justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Killian. So we have one more speaker and then we can open the floor for debate. So, Susan.
Thanks. Of course, journalism has been described as the first draft of history, but we journalists bridle at the notion that historians can be allowed to clean up our work and make it objective, and wouldn't accept that. I mean, I don't know whether I would be regarded as a historian because I've written books. Just to give an instance of the way in which all the receipt of all written knowledge about our past is contentious. My book, Northern Protestants, came out in 2000, and the late David Irvine said immediately that he found that the book was painful and true. The late then head of the Independent Orange Order said that the book was completely untrue and that nobody should bother to read it. So, you know, how there is no such thing as objective history in relation to here, and I certainly don't think that it is fair to write off storytelling projects as being somehow a lesser form of history because they weren't subject to peer review. I think that the version of history that you have represented, Killian, would be strongly contested by a lot of other historians who are equally well qualified and peer reviewed as you. I think that
I don't think I ever used the word objective.
Well, I think you did, but there is the notion that somehow there is some type of truth which can be identified by some sort of clinical means, and you used the word clinical, Adrian, whether you were agreeing that it was possible or not. But I don't know. I mean, do any of us even know now what's in the Stormont Agreement? You know, the whole institutions appear to be up in the air because of a disagreement between the two parties who agreed the agreement, who put it down in paper and said that it was there as a piece of history. So Adrian talked about finding the right atmosphere, and I think that finding the right atmosphere in this place is extremely difficult. You know, I was thinking this morning, listening to the very bitter disputes that are going on about what was or wasn't in the agreement, and thinking about, you know, we talked about in the Good Friday Agreement, we talked about constructive ambiguity. That seems like such a gentle phrase now compared with the sort of you know, Sinn Féin accusing the DUP of bad faith, the DUP saying put up or shut up to the Sinn Féin, you know, like it's just a completely different approach to conflicting narratives. I thought that I would actually read you something which, given that we're in the Art College here, it's a very interesting piece which was written by Kevin McAleer, who many of you know, who's a very great comedian from OMA, and John Byrne, who's an artist, and the two of them are very good friends. John is probably best known for his Border Interpretive Centre, in a way, you know, where he put a little hut on the border and sold bits of border turf and stuff like that, and it was a very witty sort of take on what we consider our history to be. Kevin spoke at the launch of the Border Interpretive Centre and said, "I may be biased, but in my opinion, our border is the best in the world. It unites the whole country." So you'll get the tone of this from that. It's not going to be as good with me reading it as it is with the two of them. But basically, it's you can find it on YouTube. And basically, it's Kevin and John sitting in a bar with pints in front of each other. And it's, I think it's a very good commentary on the difficulty of discussing history in this place, in Northern Ireland, stroke the North, stroke the Six Counties, whatever you want to call it. So John starts, "I myself was a bigot. I was a Protestant bigot. And I'm sure that Kevin here would admit that he was a Catholic bigot. But you know, there always was this thing of whatever you say, say nothing. But thank God that is changing. People are talking and listening and finding a lot of common ground." Kevin, "That's right. And the common thread that we are finding is our history. We've nothing to fear from history except ignorance and fear itself. Let's look at the facts. The Protestants arrived here 400 years ago. They robbed the Catholic land and drove us up to the hills like so many sheep. They did their best to brutalise our language and our culture. Our struggle goes on today to right those wrongs, and that goes on even as I suppose as we speak." You have to think of this in this during this sketch, the two of them are nodding and smiling as if in total agreement with each other. "John, I couldn't have put that better myself. These early settlers were fine, decent, upright Protestant people. And what did they find when they got here? They found a wasteland, a bog, as Kevin has said, inhabited by nomadic Roman Catholics, non-English speaking. What did they do? They built towns, they built cities, they started up industries. They transformed Ulster into the garden that we have today." Kevin, "It's so refreshing to hear John speaking of the positive aspects of our society. Our Gaelic culture is flourishing. Our population is young and rising and vibrant. We're soon going to outbreed you prods in the next 20 to 30 years. That is going to make it possible for us to vote for a united Ireland. And let me be quite clear, we will not hesitate to use the ballot box as a weapon to achieve our aims if that is what it takes to achieve our constitutional ends." John, "I share Kevin's vision of the threat of a united Ireland, and what we need is a wall. You know, we mightn't agree about the height of it, and we might quarrel, and I'm sure we will, about the thickness or the colour of it, but what we need is a wall from Newry all the way around the province to Londonderry." Kevin, "That's right, Derry." John, "I'd like to comment on something else John has said and agree with it. Roman Catholics really are breeding like rabbits, and I think a compulsory programme of sterilisation for Tagues is well overdue." Kevin, "John makes me feel ashamed of my ignorance of basic Protestant culture. It's only after meeting ordinary decent Protestants like him that I have realised that they are all walking around in a state of mortal sin, and if they were all to die tonight, God forbid the whole fascist million of them, they would go straight to hell for the catalogue of war crimes they've perpetrated against our people." John, "I share Kevin's shame. I share your shame, Kevin. I mean, it was only when I did extensive reading myself that I realised I had no idea that the Pope of Rome really was the embodiment of evil. You know, the Antichrist, and the whole dirty, unclean, unwashed shower of them are hell-bent on spreading their popery worldwide and bringing down our wee state, our wee province here. Kevin, I hear what John is saying very clearly. We cannot coerce 1 million Protestants into a united Ireland, so we've got to find some other way to get rid of them. I say let them all go back where they came from. Failing that, let them knuckle down and become Catholics like the rest of us. Smile and enjoy themselves for once in their lives. John, that's very encouraging. And I just think that is such a good take on the way that we approach history in this place. You know, it's so difficult to find a kind of vocabulary in which we can talk and be talking about the same thing at all. I mean, if you think, say, about a figure like Ian Paisley, I mean, most of us are not going to end up in the history books, let's face it, but Paisley probably is. Out of our period of history, Ian Paisley is probably going to be there. You could say of Paisley that he was a sectarian bigot, that he hated Catholics and he hated Catholicism all his life, and that he stirred up sectarian killers to carry out murders to advance his religio-political cause, and that he only gave up doing that at the point that he was going to be able to take power and dominate in a different way. Or you could say that he was a man of strong religious principle who accepted power sharing after his party had renegotiated the Good Friday Agreement, which he had called a partnership with the Men of Blood. And you could probably in history find backing for both views. So how do we know? Certainly in his terms, he considered his politics to be biblically driven, and he was frequently referred to by his supporters as God's man for the moment. And it makes me think of a friend of mine who is from Portadown, and as it happens, her mother is buried beside the grave of Billy Wright, the Loyalist paramilitary leader. And her father was visiting his wife's grave, and he happened to meet Billy Wright's father there one day, and they were standing, you know, thinking quietly about their loved ones, and Billy Wright's father said to my friend's father, well, they're both gone to the one place now. And my friend's father said, well, I like to think that your Billy has a bit more explaining to do than my wife. You know, so even, you know, and of course, even within families, you know, to go back to the storytelling notion, there are different versions of history. There are conflicting stories of what happened even within individual families, and certainly, you know, anybody from Healing Through Remembering or any of the organisations that have tried to do oral history have found that, and you know, the same thing was found by the Historical Inquiries team, and it will be found by the historical what's it called, the HIU, the Historical Inquiry Unit. Is that the right? Yeah, it'll be found by them as well. You know that there are people who cling to versions of history and will not be disabused of them because it is too painful to be so disabused. Certainly, as a journalist who has worked over quite a considerable period of the conflict and the period of transition which has followed it, it seems to me that there are a couple of narratives that are being very strongly resisted. On the Sinn Féin side, I think that the level of evidence of sectarianism in the IRA's campaign has been strongly resisted and will have to go if there is to be an honest narrative. And certainly on the loyalist or unionist side, this sheer extent of collusion is going to have to be faced up to. You know, I don't think that you can do that clean division of 60% IRA, 30% loyalist and the rest security forces, because we don't know the extent to which loyalist and security forces are joined in that history. I don't think that we are ready to write the history of the killings within the Troubles yet, because we don't know the stories of them, and whatever units are going to be set up are going to have their work cut out to find them, because existing political groupings have a very strong vested interest in resisting the discovery of those narratives. Yes, and the Irish state colluded with Republicans also. So, I mean, we've got all these different hidden narratives, and I think that storytelling, oral history, professional historians, journalists turned writers, politicians, we are all going to have difficulty finding those stories, and in the end, the histories that are written will continue to be strongly contested by the people who follow and the generations that come.
Thank you very much. Well, I think that we've got plenty of food for thought. Remember that this was billed as a debate, so we want to open this up to discussion. We have promised that we will finish the event by 2 o'clock, but of course the conversations can continue beyond that. But we have around 15 minutes. So either if people just want to make a comment or direct something at the speakers.
I'd just like to make a comment that I, for one, would be quite worried if I felt that historians, or indeed any academic group, was actually to become the keeper of such an archive, you know. And that takes me to a point we'd like to make about the storytelling. Storytelling is just one aspect of creating an archive. There will be others, but it must be remembered that storytelling is a valued and valid way of actually dealing with this situation. So that becomes, you know, a part of the archive, you know. And finally, that brings me to Killian's point in terms of, and you yourself talked about it, this idea of who killed who and who's responsible for deaths. Killian, as an historian, has just blocked out a whole new sort of debate and discussions going on around collusion. But in the book you mentioned, collusion was not necessarily high on the agenda. It is now, but you're totally blanked it out. And that's a good example why historians should not be the only keepers of such an archive. I have two comments.
Thank you.
Just basically on the same, more or less the same point about the storytelling and about the keeping of records. I mean, reflecting back to the formation of the Irish Free State, I mean, when the Civil War was over, and the War of Independence was over, and the Civil War was over, they actually hadn't got any, they really didn't know what happened, and it was only years afterwards they actually approached some of the old combatants, if you like, on both sides, and on every side, civilians and all, taking in 1916 Easter Rising. And basically what they did was they interviewed people, and they had it in the historical records, I think, in Dublin, and they kept it. I mean, is this a form of storytelling, really, you know, at the same time? And also, on the Boston tapes, is this storytelling, is it part of history? And if it goes, is it a loss, you know, to society, the future society?
We take a few more comments from the floor, and then if some of the speakers want to respond
themselves,
and then
I suppose
I
object to this to kind of be implicit. Sorry, is it me first?
No, it's you.
I object to this kind of idea of the intelligentsia as some type of secular priesthood. And I wouldn't. The idea of professional. What's that mean? I think somebody from Tigers Bay or Omni Town with access to Google could carry out research in a way that you can, somebody could review it. It could be called peer reviewed as well. Why am I cynical about these people telling us their stories? Well, what's the history of academics and journalists? Well, it's one of servility to power, whatever the prevailing system of power is, and I think there's plenty of evidence of that. So I agree with Noam Chomsky on this. I'll give you one now. Ask people in Britain how many people are dead in Iraq. Cardiff University got, it's between 2,000 and 10,000. Real figures, hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
Northern Ireland.
Now that's a result of silence and servility. So there is. I can also talk about people like Roy Greenslade, who's looked at and researched how the dominant media, whether it's the corporate media or the mainstream media in Britain, depicted depicted events here in the north. And that has a very strong burn, of course, on how people in Britain seen what went on here. And he has, of course, a hierarchy of death. And well, he's about as subjective as you are. So you are. I don't think you've ever said anything that Jim Allister would disagree with. But what the difference between you and I is I'm not claiming objectivity, or I'm not claiming that how I look at the world and how I depict it and how I see it is any way professional. It's not professional. I wouldn't be as, and I think there's an agenda behind this as well, because who's the target of this? The only people I've heard even mention from the speakers are Republicans. And by the way, Republicans need to be challenged on their narratives. Nobody says that there. But what's not said? What about the British state? And what about the institutional pressures on academics and journalists to see the world and see our society in a certain way? And I would argue that academics and journalists are as complicit, not just in events here, but in events throughout the world. So certainly I would object very, very strongly to the idea of historians being professional keepers of the truth.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll just take two more and then maybe some comments from the...
As an artist, my work is concerned with history and memory, so I'm not a historian from that background. But there's one thing which Killian hit on there, was it's going to be very difficult to have combined political history and a social history. I'm not so sure how that's going to be achieved, and how are you going to stop any fragmented party from misappropriating a little bit of history, which has been done throughout the centuries. And what I don't particularly want to see, I mean, as an Irish person, is like 100 years on, they're having arguments in Dublin now, or in South, about should we come, remember, it was about 1916 or 1922. I mean, it's 100 years to sort of sort this out. And we just can't afford that time. The young people in this country, I think it should be addressed. And the other thing is that 2016 is ridiculous out of the question.
Thank you.
Hi. Just two points. One is the point about objectivity and subjectivity, professionalism, etc. I think that... I would urge people to try and break down these boundaries between journalists, professional historians, and people who have memories and who are intelligent and well-spoken and articulate. I think what needs to be focused on is not the individual. Just because you're a professor of history in a prestigious higher education institution does not mean that you are capable of writing objective histories. We all know this. Professional historians know that we all have our subjective biases. What you need to look at is the quality of the adjudication, and that has to do with the institutions, the ownership of media, the way that higher education institutions are run, and the way that oral history projects are run. It's the quality of the adjudication and the critique that's allowed there. So it's really provocative, I think, that one of the most provocatively truthful things we heard today was in the genre of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth reflecting on why that's the case. The other point is about time frame. Susan said about it may be too early to forget what you said.
I don't remember.
Too early to write a history, mm-hmm. but it is quite often too early to write a history. I think this goes to your point about the Civil War. Professional historiography is a closed shop, and I understand these criticisms. I have a PhD in history, and it's taken me a long time to survive as one. It's a very small industry, and it can become quite claustrophobic and internal to itself. But nevertheless, it's a very long game, there have been developed professional scientific techniques for working through the evidence that history throws up, and it does take time, and it takes energy and time as well. The higher education system in the United Kingdom now, which is focused entirely on STEM subjects, it's going to be harder and harder to write proper histories.
Can I ask the speakers just to respond very briefly, so that if there are more questions from the floor, that we have still a few minutes.
Yeah, I'll go first. I was going to sort of answer your question on, you know, the difference between a professional historian and someone who doesn't have any sort of training writing a history. I think you make a good point. It was answered in some ways by the gentleman who just spoke. You know, people with a PhD in history are supposedly trained in scientific methods of how to interrogate sources and present evidence objectively. But I don't think any of us would say that we're completely objective. But the other thing about that is non-professional historians can sometimes be given a very bad rap. I'll give you an example of that is the controversy over an ambush during the Civil War, where Peter Hart, a professional historian, wrote a version of that event. He was contradicted by bloggers, mainly, to start off with, who were dismissed as cranks who didn't know what they were talking about by the professional historians. And it's only now that professional historians are starting to come on board with that alternative viewpoint. So I agree with you in some ways about that. Again, power is a factor in how history is written by professionals or by people within academia. I alluded to that earlier when I was speaking about the potential for career advancement or the potential to have a career at all as a historian can have an effect on the way history is written. If a young historian is afraid to write the history as they see it for fear that it will rock the boat a little bit too much, then the history that is being produced it doesn't have any bite. It's not really getting to the core of the issues. It's consensus based on what the established view is. And sometimes we need to rely on people who aren't trying to make a career as a professional historian to actually write some of the more hard-hitting stuff. I'll keep it brief, but I'll just ask Killian if he could, when he was making his remarks, if he could maybe explain what he sees as the difference between oral history and storytelling as a product, and why he sees the need for storytelling to be peer-reviewed. I'm not sure of much oral history that is peer-reviewed. Usually oral history is a source that would be written into a history, whether it's a book or an article, and then peer-reviewed. So I just didn't get what the point of peer review and storytelling would be.
So do you want to take that up?
Yeah.
Because that's a direct question to you.
Yeah, can I, because I was going to address that in any case. Before I address that, I mean, I think Susan has entered, I don't know if she wasn't, I mean, I can understand your point of view, so I can't really understand why you can't understand the paper, the presentations that Adrian and I were given. It seems that your point of view is that
they were very interesting.
That, well, it doesn't seem to be, because you introduced this term of objectivity into the debate that seems to have sidelined, because the very idea, as this, the gentleman over there has spoken it, it's passé. The idea of objectivity within history as a discipline is completely passé. And really, I don't really understand. I mean, I don't know what you're left with then if you're just going to end up, as you concluded, to say, well, somebody has their story and somebody else has their story, and you've Kevin McAleer and somebody else. It's completely facetious and it's completely vacuous.
Absolutely isn't vacuous. I think, as the historian here said, it's an interesting slant on truth.
Okay.
It's not vacuous. It's not vacuous.
Yeah, and sometimes somebody within a family has some story and somebody else has another.
It's
of
contested.
Course.
That doesn't mean that I'm saying that you don't look
I mean,
for
it's
the
a
evidence.
Truism. Of course people have different stories, right? I mean,
can I just say, my name is Martin Dowling, so I don't have to be the gentleman anymore. So I didn't mean to imply that objectivity was passé. What I meant to say was that it can't be done alone, and it is the quality of the peer review, if you like, or the adjudication or the deliberation around what is said by the solo historian that brings us closer to objectivity.
I mean, I think it's a relative to, I mean, you've really outlined my response to Adrian's question, which is, it's the standards to which these initiatives, these projects are held. I mean, I don't, it's important because I don't consider myself a victim, or I can't speak for anybody else other than myself, and I don't want to denigrate anybody's experiences or anybody's stories. as has been alluded to in the speakers over here, I completely concur. Why should academics or elites of any kind be given the running of this? Because these are people's stories, they're their possessions. Why should, and I alluded to this in my presentation where I suggested there's privatised mourning and privatised memory. Why should people's stories be given over? It's their property in a way. My point was that contained in the Hitchens point that it undersells what storytelling does in a way. Storytelling, conflating storytelling with something that it's not, actually works to undersell and works to give these stories over to these kind of standardized processes that have been alluded to. I don't know how that was missed, and the idea that this is some kind of objective process was entered in, because I think that takes us off down a line of academics or journalists or political elites or moneyed powerful interest versus essentially victims, and I don't find that very helpful at all. I don't find it very helpful either, the truism that within families everybody has their own perspective. So what? Everybody knows that.
I don't think everybody does know that, and when I was looking at putting together my papers for today, I found a brochure for an art exhibition which was held in the F.E. McWilliams Gallery recently, and the title of the exhibition was "The Past is Unpredictable," and I think that, you know, these are complex ideas. They're not fatuous, they're not facetious, they're not simplistic. They are actually about the way that people of all kinds of different disciplines are trying to approach something that everybody in this society in this period of transition is trying to work out what happened, what went on, what was all that blood and grief about, you know, and that is history, but everybody is coming at it from a different perspective. I mean, if you want to go looking up Twitter and Google and Wikipedia to find out your sources, I don't think that those are necessarily going to give you more truth than a journalist going out onto the doorstep and asking somebody a question. I think that the term that Martin used is appropriate for all of us. It is about the quality of adjudication, and that in journalistic terms, that is about seeking evidence. It's about going to people, asking questions, trying to verify what they said. And it is all very painful in a period like this for people. And so what is not an appropriate response to that kind of question, because, like, if you look at some of the work that went into Lost Lives, for example, the great book of the dead of the conflict, it recently emerged, I think it may have emerged as a result of some of the research that was done by the group of historians and journalists who produced that amazing book. There was one instance where a child in Derry who had been assumed by his family to have been killed by the British Army turned out to have been killed by the IRA. You know, I mean, that is appalling for that family to have. And there was another family that I've worked with, for example, in Donegal, who were a Protestant family living in Donegal, and they felt very intimidated by the fact that they thought that their younger brother had been killed by the IRA, and they kept their heads down over many years of living in quite a Republican community because of that fact. And when Lost Lives was published, they learned from Lost Lives that the young boy had in fact been killed by loyalists. You know, so people live with these versions of history which turn out to be false. So it's really, I don't think we should use dismissive language about each other's versions of truth in that regard.
I'm using dismissive language.
You said I was being fatuous. Yeah. You said that the Kevin McAleer, John Byrne thing was facetious. It just isn't. It's a really interesting take on the way that we can all talk in parallel monologues and not listen to each other.
Well, your spiel there is emblematic of
a monologue. Be respectful.
Right. Well, your monologue there.
Respectfully
right,
to
okay.
you.
Your monologue there is emblematic of just what you're talking about.
Okay, but we have one
can
more
I just,
person.
Grania, can I just come in because it's important to me? I'm not saying so what to people, and I made this perfectly clear whenever I said all due respect for people's stories, so I don't know why you're framing that in an alternative way. I said my point about being dismissive was to the idea that there is complexity in history. Everybody knows there's complexity in history.